And we've been talking about the Troyer's Hollow event that we have every summer. Towards the end of June, I think it's the Sunday after Father's Day, I believe, usually, and which is what it is today, this week. And or not today, but this week, which Father's Day was last Sunday. And I wanted to ask, who has been to Troyer's Hollow before? There's quite a few people have been there. And if you haven't been, I hope you get the opportunity to go at some point. It's well worth the trek down there. It's about a little over an hour from here to go down there. And I'll just give you a little short history leading into my subject. I'll give you a little short history of Troyer's Hollow, or as we used to call it when I was a kid. It was down in the area that I grew up in, so we used to go there from time to time. We used to call it the Doughty, and that's D-O-U-G-H-T-Y. And it's about a 2 mile long narrow gorge, fairly deep valley that through which Doughty Creek runs. Doughty Creek is a fairly significant stream, and it can get really significant when it rains real hard, because it being so narrow, it just instant floodwaters rise. Last year, as a matter of fact, some of the folks got stranded there and had on the other side of the creek, and I'm using the colloquial term for creek, I'm going to say crick, because that's what we call them at home. That's the country name for a creek, crick. So when Doughty Creek started to rise, as it did last year, we shuffled people who absolutely had to leave back and forth till it got to the point where we just couldn't get through it anymore, and those folks were trapped on the other side, on the west side of the creek, and couldn't get out. They eventually got out, I think, sometime the next morning, most of them, maybe a few of them a little earlier, because I think maybe a tractor came in and shuttled a few people back out that just absolutely had to leave. So that can happen. In 1969, our family had their family reunion there, the Wengard family, and it was on the 4th of July, which we always have a reunion then. And that evening, after we had left, it started raining, and it flooded, and it pretty much washed the whole little valley away. It pretty much devastated it, and that happens periodically. I think it's happened within the last probably 100 years about three times since 1935. That has happened. But if you've never been there, if you were going there, you'd be surprised and a little bit amazed, because you'd be traveling down 557, which is a state highway from Berlin towards Charm, Ohio, down in Amish country. Traffic going both ways, horses, buggies, cars, trucks, whatever. You'd be traveling along, and then you veer off on this little gravel road, up this little gravel road, and there's still traffic on there. And there's houses on the left-hand side, and even some small bed and breakfasts, two or three or four of them, along the road there. And you're on the right side, it's mostly fields and woods. And you come to this field, and there's a gate, and there's a little lane that goes in through the gate along at the end of the field and along a little tree line. And you turn in there, and you head down into the woods. It's just a little gentle slope down into the woods, and you get into the woods, and all of a sudden you think you're in West Virginia. It just starts winding and straight down. And I know some of the folks here have brought campers. I don't know how they do it. They're very adventurous. I would be a little leery or hesitant myself to take a camper there, but it's done, and they camp down there. But it's a very, very narrow, what seems like a treacherous little road going almost straight down, as you would find in West Virginia. I went whitewater rafting one time in West Virginia, and the most exciting part of the whole thing was the trip up out of there with the bus. And it'd be a little bit like that here. The exciting part is getting down and back up out of there, one of the exciting parts. Because when you get down there, it's quiet. There's hardly anything but the birds that you hear, no sounds. You're completely insulated and isolated from the rest of the world, it seems like. And you're only a half a mile off the beaten path. But you're down in this hollow, in this valley, and it's totally quiet, except for the people or cars that we bring down there and so forth, the children playing and so on. And it's very quiet, sublime. It's very serene down there, and very, it's very much a place where you would like to spend the Sabbath. I know I have, pretty much every time I've ever gone there, it has been so peaceful and so so serene and so very quiet, and such a natural place to have the Sabbath that it just enhances your Sabbath keeping. It almost can't, you can't help but be inspired when you're there. And I hope at some point most of you could make it down there if you want to. But at one, nobody, for example, knows for sure where the name came from, the Doughty. Some think it came from a fellow named Colonel Doughty, who was, I think, the land officer in the town of Cambridge that had jurisdiction over that general area, I'm guessing. And some people feel that was where it came from. Others think it came from an Indian chief named Chief Doughty, who also apparently was in the area. And either one of those are possibilities. Either one of it could have been the case. But at one time, it was sort of a fairly hustling, bustling little place, even down there in the valley with the steep hills and cliffs going up the side and all the trees. There were mills on the, at least two, maybe even three mills on Doughty Creek. There was a grist mill, and there was a woolen mill, and maybe even a lumber mill for cutting timber or for cutting trees into boards. I'm not sure about the third one, but I believe there were three at one point, at one time. And there were houses. People lived down there. You wouldn't really know that today because it's most all every vestige of that is gone, except for there's a cement abutment and little indication of where the mill, one of the mills was when you get down into the valley. But it's a lot different today than it was then. But there have been many of Church of God baptisms in Doughty Valley as well. And I believe there's going to be one today, at least one, down there today. I think quite a few of the Miller family in the past have been baptized down in that area. And you could ask them, they'd probably tell you who all it was. I'm not sure who, but quite a few people have been. There's a... As you drive through the stream as you get in there, and as you get in there to the left of where you're driving through the stream, there's a fairly deep hole where the baptisms take place, right there by the, in view of the campers and in view of the building that we usually use for services and the kitchens and so forth. The picture, though, of Troyer's Hollow, or the Doughty, as we used to call it, that I have in my mind is of a stream lined with trees with a tree-covered banks on each side. Trees are a blessing from God. Here in America, we are blessed with a great variety of trees. We have many, many trees here, many different kinds of all kinds for fruit trees, and we have them from the giant sequoias, which are the largest trees in the world in the Sierra Nevadas out in California, to the oldest trees in the world, the bristlecone pines, also in California, in probably not too far from where the giant sequoias are. But the bristlecone pines, while the giant sequoias may reach 250 feet in height, the bristlecone pines are a smaller tree that just is eking out a living. And some of them look like they're barely alive at all. They may just have a few patches of green on a little scrubby-looking tree. And, of course, it is a pine tree. But the oldest one in that area, they think is, or they have done measurements and all kinds of testing, and they believe it's over 5,000 years old, which is the oldest living thing in the world. And they're all of those things, all those trees and so forth, are in the United States, are in America. Which brings me to my message. And no, it's not age, because I could talk about that. I'm probably qualified. But it's not age, it's trees. I'd like to talk about trees. The Bible opens and closes with trees. If you turn with me back to Genesis, the first chapter, and while we're going there, I'll just mention a third of the world is covered with trees. Approximately a third of the world is covered with trees. At one time, most of North America, east of the Mississippi, was pretty much covered with trees because we hadn't gotten here and we began to cut trees like we shot buffalo. We just indiscriminately did it thinking they'd last forever. But then people began to realize that if we keep up at this rate, we'll deforest this part of the country. And they began to have conservation programs where they, if they cut trees, they planted trees and so forth, which is a great thing. But the Bible opens, as I said, in the very first chapter, it says in verse 27 of Genesis 1, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And here we come to the trees. And God said in verse 29, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food." And then going into chapter 2 and verse 7, again it repeats that the Lord made man of the dust of the earth. In verse 8, "The Lord planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground the Lord made every tree grow that is pleasant to the sight." In other words, they're beautiful, but they're also functional. They also provide things. "That it's pleasant to the sight and it's good for food. The tree of life was also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." So the tree of life was right there in the garden in the beginning, as was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Then, as I said, the Bible closes also with trees. In Revelation 22, which is the last chapter of the Bible, we find in verse 1, "And he showed me," this being the angel, that was John, as you know, was on the Isle of Patmos, and he had this vision, this revelation that was brought to him by Jesus Christ and his angel. "And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the middle of its street and on either side of the river was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each tree yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the trees were for the healing of the nation." And then in verse 14, "Blessed are those who do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life." Again, the same tree that it says was in the Garden of Eden, the tree of life. "And that he may enter through the gates into the city." Going on back in verse 19, it also states, "If anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God shall take away his part from," it says the book of life, but the margin points out that it means a tree of life, "from the holy city and from the things which are written in this book." So, as I say, the Bible opens and closes with trees. There are hundreds of references to trees in the Bible. Some name kinds, sycamore, fir, any kind, oak, olive, fir, cedar. The cedars of Lebanon, you might remember those. And all kinds of fruit trees, the Bible mentions that, but it also mentions trees in general. All throughout the Bible, as I say, there are hundreds of trees mentioned in the Bible. References all throughout. But what the tree that I want to talk about, or the kind of tree, it's not in the beginning or the end. The tree that I want to be talking about is in the middle of the Bible. In Psalms 1, the first chapter of Psalms is where that's found. And by the way, the title of the message is Like a Tree. And it's taken from this psalm here. It says, Blessed in Psalm 1, in verse 1, Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. In other words, we're not standing up for evil, or we're not taking the side of evil. We're not arrogant and boastful and scornful. But his delight, in other words, his good pleasure, his delight, that man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly or stands in the path of sinners, his delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law, he meditates. And the margin is it's sort of interesting what the margin says about meditating. It says he ponders by talking to himself. And maybe we all do that sometimes, talk to ourselves. We probably do. But as we think about these things, we're sort of internally talking to ourselves as we meditate in the law of the Lord. And in his law he meditates day and night. He, and this is the man that we're talking about, he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. Now, there is a reason why that is, why its leaf shall not wither, and whatever he prospers, and it brings forth its fruit in its season. Excuse me. But why are trees so important that they're mentioned throughout the Bible? To answer that and give us a greater appreciation for trees and what trees can do, I'd like to tell you the story of my dad's favorite tree, and I thought it was interesting. Last Sunday, as I mentioned, was Father's Day, and I thought it was interesting that David Ritter in his sermonette also mentioned his dad and grandfather and so on, and he mentioned some of the things in a way in the same manner as what I'm going, the path I'm going down. But at any rate, the story of my favorite, dad's favorite tree sort of points out what this particular verse and what this portion in this little section of scripture shows here. When you think about it and you look at it, here is a tree planted by the river. It's a very idyllic, very simple setting that we're looking at. Fruit trees, leaves that don't wither, and prosperity. And it's all because this particular person delighted and meditated in God's law, which meant he also did God's law, as we read in Revelation, that the commandments of God will give us by doing what we're supposed to and what God tells us to do, what God asks us to do and instructs us to do. By doing that, we will have right to the tree of life, which was in the garden in Eden, and also will be there, as it said in Revelation, at the end. But this particular tree that was my dad's favorite, we'll get to that in a minute. First, I wanted to mention, we have lost in this country some of the best varieties of trees that there were. Now, we still have plenty and lots of great trees, but there were two trees in particular, the chestnut tree that we lost to the chestnut blight in the early 1900s, which the chestnut tree was a much more valuable tree than we probably give it credit for now. It was a straight-grained, easy-to-work-with, lighter-than-oak tree. It was easy to make buildings with. They used it because it was so rot-resistant, and it had tannins in it, which was a type of an oil that came out of it that kept it from rotting, and it made great fence posts, telephone poles, buildings. They could make pole buildings with chestnut trees because they were like similar to the treated material that we have today without the chemicals. They resisted rot and they resisted decay. And so they could be used for a lot of different things. They used them for shingles as well because they were so well, so rot resistant. And that you could use those. A lot of homes, especially in southern Ohio, West Virginia, houses and barns and so forth, they were, I'm not sure how far west they went, if they went all the way to the Mississippi or not, but they were primarily an eastern tree. But in the forests of the eastern United States, from Maine to Florida, and as I mentioned, I know they got all the way up into Michigan, so they got further west than Ohio. But the chestnut tree was an important tree of its day for not only the timber that it provided, but for the nuts, the fruit, the chestnuts that it provided. In the fall, people would gather those by the wagon loads, and they would take them to town and they would sell them. People bought them to feed their animals with because they had high protein and they were a very nutritious type of a nut that was in big abundance. And they could be used for many different things. They were good just to eat, but they were great roasted, or they were great for your cattle. And it was a cash crop for people in areas where the chestnuts thrived and where there were lots of chestnut trees. And they ended up, you've probably heard of wormy chestnut, and that is because trees would die and they would fall over, blow over, and then types of bugs or worms would get in them and make little holes in them. And they became quite highly figured and prized for making furniture, wormy chestnut furniture, but that was only a byproduct of what happened to them later on. So these chestnut trees, they were generally replaced with things like oak and then elm and so on. But then in the second half of the 1900s, around the mid portion of the 1900s, chestnut or the Dutch elm disease began attacking the elm trees. And the difference between the chestnut tree was not primarily a good shade tree. The elm tree was highly valued for its shade in cities, especially, and anywhere where their shade trees were prized and valued and used, because they were not like the maple trees that we have that are sort of an umbrella type of a tree. They were more of a vase-shaped tree, and they made tremendous shade because they blocked out the sun's rays, but they still weren't low to the ground like the maples are, where it's sometimes even hard to mow under them. They were a nice tree for making shade, and they were also valued and highly prized for the wood. It's a highly figured grain that elm trees have, and they were very much in demand for that, for wood, for furniture and so forth, mostly probably furniture, but other things as well. But the Dutch elm disease ended up wiping it out pretty much in total. They will still, you'll still here and there see elm trees that maybe get up to 12 to possibly 16 inches in diameter, but then they end up dying. I was watching one along the route I travel a lot, and it was a beautiful tree, very well shaped. It was almost a perfect example of an elm tree, but last summer or the summer before, it was in the middle of summer, all of a sudden it died. The leaves died, and now they've cut the tree down and it's gone. It was probably, I would say, 14 to 16 inches, which is about as big as they get, and then they die off. And now another one of our highly valued trees, the ash tree, is also being assaulted and under attack. It's being the emerald ash borer, which was, I think the emerald ash borer might have come from Asia. We used to be quarantined by those kind of things by distance because the oceans separated us from everybody, but now quick travel back and forth, they're bringing things back and forth, diseases come with it as well. And that's what happened to the ash tree. They're making a valiant effort to quarantine or keep them, the ash borer, away from the ash trees, but I don't know how they're doing in that battle. It seems like they might be losing the battle. But ash trees, again, they're very much valued. They're similar to an oak tree in their grain and so forth. They make baseball bats out of them. It's a big thing they make out of ash. But they make a lot of furniture from ash, and it's a highly desired tree and wood for making furniture and things. But trees provide many, many things, and we miss the trees that are no longer here for that reason, because they provided something beneficial to America, to the United States, to the farmers and the timber folks that used to cut those trees, or those who managed them, or those who used them for shade and so forth, and they're missed. But trees, there are many, many things that trees provide. Oxygen, I used to know, or I've read, how much, what percentage of our oxygen is provided by trees and vegetation, and it's pretty extensive. Water also, oceans also provide oxygen and other things, but mostly the vegetation is what provides most of it. But we have fruit trees that produce almost any kind of fruit. Olive, now we don't have those in this area, but we do have them in California and places. Olive trees, we have apple trees, peaches, plums, pears, almost any kind of fruit that you could name grows on a tree. Not every fruit grows on a tree, because we have raspberries and strawberries and so forth, but even tomatoes, which don't grow on trees but are a fruit. But nonetheless, all of these different fruits that we have, if you go back to Genesis 1 and verse 29, you remember that it said, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is in the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food." That's what trees were for food. They were for to eat. They were for lumber, to provide housing for us. The lumber business at one time was probably the biggest business in the United States, in America, at the timber business at one time. But of course, it might have been rivaled by a couple other things, but it was one of the biggest businesses in the country. But it's still big, but it's not the biggest. There are many other things that we have surpassed it now as being bigger than the timber business. But timber provided lumber for homes. Most homes at one time were made of either wood or stone, or wood and stone. The home I grew up on was a wooden frame house with hand-hewn sandstone. And timber, that's what timber provided. Solomon in Kings, the First Kings, from chapter 6 to chapter 9, is the description of the building of Solomon's temple. And in 6:14 and verse 14 and 15, 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 14, just a little description. It doesn't talk so much about the big beams that were made, but there were that also. It said, "So Solomon built the temple," in verse 14, 1 Kings 6, "and finished it, and he built the inside walls of the temple with cedar boards. From the floor of the temple to the ceiling, he paneled the inside with wood, and then he covered the floor of the temple with planks." And then if you drop over to verse 18, or down to verse 18, they said, "Inside the temple was cedar, carved with ornamental buds and open flowers. All was cedar. There was no stone to be seen." And that must have been quite a gorgeous building, edifice, the temple, as the apostles or disciples came to Christ at one time. It's in Matthew 24 and also in Luke 21, I think. They came to Jesus, and they pointed out the magnificent buildings of the temple and how beautiful they were. And they were. Now, that was, I don't believe, Solomon's temple. That was the one that was built after that. But nonetheless, it was still a gorgeous building. And Solomon's temple probably was beyond compare almost, because of the beauty of all the wood and all the ornamentation that had been carved into the wood of the temple. there are many, many, many other things that are also of value that wood provides. For one thing, rubber comes from wood. The rubber tires that we have on our cars comes from wood. It comes from, I'm trying to remember the trees or the area that a lot of it comes from, but at any rate, a lot of the rubber comes from wood, and medicines also come from wood. We also already read in Revelation, the 22nd chapter, about the healing, but Ezekiel also mentions Ezekiel 47, and in verse 12. We'll just take a quick look there. Ezekiel 47 and in verse 12. And here it's picturing a time, the same time that is talked about in the book of Revelation. In verse 12 it says, along the bank of the river, on this side and that, will grow all kinds of trees used for food. Their leaves will not wither, and their fruit will not fail. Their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for medicine. And that's probably going to be of much more value in at this time period, which is in the kingdom of God, than it is now, because we'll probably know a lot more about the healing properties of certain trees than we do now. But we already use some things for medicine, or have discovered that trees provide medicine for the healing of people. And they've been used for many, many years. Now they're pretty much refined, but at that point, they will probably be, there will be other uses that we'll discover from them. But getting to, well, let's not get ahead of myself. There's a couple other things I wanted to point out that trees are used for. One thing, and this we can probably, a lot of us can say yes. Even coffee, to some extent, comes from trees, although coffee is more of a bush than a tree. But one of the other things that is near and dear to my heart that trees provide, and that is tone woods and soundboards for instruments. Now, I brought a couple of my instruments along because we're going to play some music at Troyer's Hollow this evening, so I had to bring them along because I'm heading from here down to there. And so I brought them so that I don't have to go back home to get them. But at any rate, musical instruments, there are all kinds of wood that are tone woods and soundboard woods. For one of the most expensive wood that is not really even available anymore because it's quarantined is Brazilian rosewood. It's a, it's, you can no longer get it because it's becoming extinct in its home country. But Brazilian rosewood made some of the finest guitars, and also furniture for that matter, but some of the finest guitar backs and sides that you can purchase. An instrument that is sold today that has a Brazilian rosewood back and sides on it would automatically be worth at least $1,000 more than one without it, because they're that good and they're that beautiful. And the soundboard's the same way. Soundboards are, for example, the top of a guitar is a soundboard. And one of the reasons that musical instruments these woods are so near and dear to my heart is because I love the beauty of fine instruments, the look of them, whether it's a violin, or I should maybe say a fiddle, or its uppity sister, the violin. Well, either one of those, they're made with some of the most beautiful curly maple wood that you'd ever see. And so are mandolins, which is what I have myself. But notice in Psalm 144, towards the latter part of Psalms, it does have 144 chapters. It actually has a couple more. Psalm 144 and verse 9, and it doesn't specifically mention wood here, but it says, I will sing a new song to you, O God, on a harp of 10 strings. I will sing praises to you. Now, the harps were made with wood and strings. They were probably somewhat the precursor to our guitars and the stringed instruments that we have today, the violins and so forth, the fiddles and whatnot. But they were also, you would have probably had to use some kind of tone wood for making the harps, because they were made out of wood and then they had strings stretched across them. But all these things was not why this one particular tree was my dad's favorite. And as I get into the background of that, I want to give you a little bit of background. We moved on to, when I was a youngster, we moved on to what was called the Worthy Burrell Farm. And the Burrells were fairly well known in that part of Ohio, Tuscarawas County. In Ohio, we were just across the line from Holmes County into Tuscarawas County, and they had developed this farm that we moved onto, and this particular tree was probably my favorite tone wood and soundboard wood, and that's a maple tree. And it's for several reasons. It's my favorite, but I'll get to that in a minute. This particular tree stood by a little stream, ironically enough. It was a big, big maple tree. And the Burrell family, when they moved there, I don't know how they got the farm, whether it was a land grant, which many of those kind of tracts of land were, or whether it was through a purchase of some kind. But nonetheless, they owned a quite significant chunk of land there, and with a hill behind our house. And on the hill behind our house was a powerful spring. But springs, developing springs, is an artwork. A spring will not really amount to much unless it's developed. And there are probably not very many people who know how to develop a spring anymore, but some of our forefathers and our grandfathers and even maybe some of our fathers had a pretty good idea of how to develop a spring and keep it going, and they did. This spring ran out of the hill, and it was piped down to our house, where it kept our butter and eggs and our cream cold in a little trough, ran through there into our milk house, where it kept our milk cold when we milked the cows, and then it ran into the barn where we could use it for the animals to have water to drink. It was constantly flowing, so it never froze up. And it was a strong spring. I never remember it ever having slowed down or stopped. Even in some of the driest summers, it really didn't stop, or it really didn't quit running. It still ran fairly strong. And this little stream ran right by that tree, between the tree and the barn. Now, this farm, then it ran from there on down into a ditch which ran down into the Trail Creek, along which an Indian trail ran. And that particular stream along there were Indian camps when, obviously long before we got there. But the Burrell family stopped by one day when I was probably 7 or 8, and they must have been in their 80s already, some of their children, or some of the Burrell family. And they said that when they were kids, this was in a valley, we lived in a valley with ridge on either side, they said that they could hear, and it scared them to death, they could hear the Indians at night calling from one ridge to the other, calling to each other, and it frightened them to death. But they said nothing ever really happened. It was just a scary sound, probably like wolves howling or coyotes howling or something like that would maybe scare some people today. But that little stream ran on down into the creek along with a lot of others and then ran off. But nonetheless, this particular maple tree was one of my favorites because I could climb on it. It was one of the trees that had limbs low enough to where I could actually grab them, climb up into the tree, probably to my mother's chagrin, and because I doubt that she was all that excited about it. But it provided a lot of entertainment for us. This is where we did our butchering, and this one of the reasons I had to be baptized. We butchered pigs under that tree, and we had the big kettles with where they rendered the lard, and they made cracklings. And the kids, we'd always try to eat as many cracklings as we could get away with before our parents caught us. but I thought they were great. And like I say, that, which is probably one of the least of the things, it was one of the reasons I needed to be baptized and forgiven, as all of us do. But none of those things was why this was my dad's favorite tree. This was a big tree that provided a lot of things, but the biggest thing that it provided, we were Amish farmers, and we farmed with horses. When it got to be time to be for lunchtime, we had teams of horses that were six horses wide, which is probably, if you do the math, it's probably anywhere from 25 to 30 feet wide, or maybe even a little wider than that. We could bring our horses in under those trees, and the whole team would fit under that tree, and with the help of a little bit of feed, some water, and the cooling effects of that tree, in 45 minutes to an hour, he could be ready to go back out to the fields for the afternoon's work. Now, there's a, that, we take all that for granted. We think that all just happens, that it's cool under a tree. I didn't know why, and I don't think my dad did either, why it was so much cooler under the tree than it was in the surrounding area. But the reason it was so cool under that tree is called transpiration. I don't know if you've ever heard of transpiration, if you know what it is, or if you have read about it or studied about it. You may have, some people have. But it's the way that a tree feeds and cools itself. A tree will, and this is why the stream, like it is in Psalms 1, is why the stream is so important. A tree, if it gets too dry, the leaves will wither. Now, what that does is it turns them in, and there's less surface for the hot sun to hit it and to warm it. So there'll be less surface for it to do that. But it also, if it gets too dry and it has no water, it'll start losing leaves to protect itself so that it doesn't have to provide food and energy for it. So it'll lose leaves until it could completely defoliate if there is no water and if the drought is too severe. But a tree that is by the water, as it says, planted by the water, its leaf will not wither and it will produce fruit. And here is why. Transpiration is a process that takes water in through the roots. It sucks it in a sucking action like you would on a straw up through the sapwood, out into the leaves, and then there are pores that open up. It brings minerals along with it when it does that to feed the tree and keep it growing. But it cools itself by that because as it comes up, the sun hits it and it evaporates, and there are pores on the underside of the leaf that will allow the water to escape or the vapor to escape and thereby cool itself and the surrounding area. Now, it's not just as easy as all that either. It has little thermostats in by the pores, little cells, thermostatic cells that are by the pores of the tree, or of the leaf rather, that regulate how much vapor can be released from the leaves. That thermostat over here on the wall is not nearly as sophisticated as those thermostats on that tree is. It monitors heat, wind, humidity. It monitors a whole host of things. It's also sensitive to light. And all of those things it regulates so that it releases the right amount of vapor into the air, just what it needs to cool itself. And it will cool itself and the surrounding areas from 5 to 20 degrees. I didn't know why it was so much cooler under that tree. I don't think my dad knew why it was so much cooler under that tree, other than that the leaves block the sun, which is another effect that it does. But there's always a breeze under a good tree for that reason, because it's creating a temperature difference, which causes wind or air to circulate. A full-grown maple tree, and we see them all the time, a full-grown maple tree can transpirate as much as 40 to 60 gallons of water an hour every day, if it has the water available. But it has to have the water available. Hence the importance of the tree living by the waters. And that's what David was talking about when he wrote the first Psalm. That's why he gave it importance, the importance of being planted by the rivers of water. And speaking of water, I can use it myself. As I said, as a little Amish boy, I knew nothing about all that. I just knew that it was more comfortable. We had no air conditioning, so we did second best. We used water and we used shade to keep ourselves cool. And here it mentions that a person could actually be like that tree. A person could be as productive or as could be as fruitful as a tree if he's planted in the right by the rivers of water, as it says here. If his delight is in the law of the Lord and in his law he meditates day and night. We can be like that. We can be cooling and beneficial to other people, those around us, if we practice what it says here, if we take the opportunity. But mostly I just wanted to let you know these things so that we can appreciate God's creation a little bit more and a little bit better, and try to take those examples and use them and practice them in our own life. Trees are not valued like they used to be. Now that there's air conditioning, it's sort of blasé. Shade is not what it used to be, because it's, we get from our air-conditioned houses 72 degrees to our air-conditioned cars to the air-conditioned store or wherever we're going, and we don't need shade. We don't need trees as much. But trees provide a lot of things that are not noticed. When you see that tree out there, it's doing a lot more than just looking pretty and standing there. It's actually performing a function. Today, we're in a concrete and steel and plastic world. I know they call it vinyl siding, but it's plastic. It's our countertops are generally made out of plastic and so forth. Used to be wood and stone mostly. But houses now are concrete, steel. There's some of them that still are made out of wood, but not like they used to be. Our food is now being modified. Trees are being modified. They call it genetic modification, or a genetically modified organism instead of a natural tree or natural food that we used to get. And it's more prevalent than we really realize. I think that most of the corn we get is genetically modified. It's, in fact, commercially, it's pretty much all genetically modified. But trees add a lot of things and a lot of value to our life. The beauty of trees in the fall is incomparable. That tree that was standing by that little stream close to our barn, it would look like a house afire in the fall. It would be all red and orange and flame yellow, and it was beautiful. And I didn't probably like to rake the leaves when they came down, but beyond that, it was tremendous. Although we use the leaves for a lot of things, bedding and in the garden and so forth. Not our bedding, but for our animals. And so they added a lot of value even at that point. And one spring, Mom and I did, and I know there are people here that have done this. We made maple syrup out of that tree, and that was one of my favorite things, the maple syrup that we got from that tree. But they provide oxygen. They provide air filtration, clean air. Where you have more trees, you have cleaner air, and it's easier to breathe. If you have a respiratory issue, you'll appreciate that. Other things that trees provide are obviously food and fruit and so forth. And we can't even name all the things trees provide, because we don't even probably know what all trees do provide. But they're part of God's awesome creation. And God says that we could be like a tree, that we could stand out there, even if it doesn't seem like much is happening, we can still be providing benefits to those around us. The one problem that occurs, though, is as with many, many things, we pervert what God has made. In Isaiah the 44th chapter, if you would turn there, it talks about the uselessness of worshiping idols. And this is what happens with trees. We are to worship the Creator and not the creation. We are to appreciate the creation and worship the Creator. Isaiah 44 in verse 9 and 10. Verse 9 says, "Those who make an image, all of them are useless, and their precious things shall not profit. They are their own witnesses. They neither see nor know, that they may be ashamed. Who would form a god or mold an image that profits him nothing?" Who would do such a thing? Who would waste their time in doing that? Turn over to to verse 14 further on. It said, "He cuts down cedars for himself and takes the cypress and the oak. He secures it for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a pine and the rain nourishes it. Then it shall be for a man to burn, for he will take some of it and warm himself. He kindles it and bakes bread. Indeed, he makes a god and worships it on top of that. He bakes bread with it, warms himself. Then he turns around and uses the rest of it and makes a carved image and bows down to it. He burns half of it in the fire. With this half, he eats meat. He roasts a roast and is satisfied. He even warms himself and says, 'Ah, I am warm. I have seen the fire.' And the rest of it he makes into a god, his carved image. He falls down before it and worships it, prays to it and says, 'Deliver me, for you are my God.' They do not know nor understand, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see and their hearts so that they cannot understand." And here is the interesting thing. "And no one considers in his heart, nor is there knowledge nor understanding to say, 'I have burned half of it in the fire. Yes, I have also baked bread on its coals. I have roasted meat and eaten it, and shall make the rest of it an abomination. Shall I fall down before a block of wood?'" He asks the question. No, but on the other hand, in Psalm 104, he says what we should do instead. Psalm 104, and he starts out, this is a psalm of praise. "Bless the Lord, O my soul," it says in verse 1. Then going on to verse 14, "He causes the grass to grow for the cattle and vegetation for the service of man." Trees, plants, vegetables, and so on are for our benefit and our help, "that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine that makes glad the heart of man, oil to make his face shine and bread which strengthens man's heart. The trees of the Lord are full of sap, the cedars of Lebanon which he planted, where the birds make their nests, the stork has her home in the fir tree." God made this for us, and then he ends up saying, David does, at the end of the chapter, in verse 35, he says, "Praise the Lord for all these things." And he lists other things here as well, but trees are just part of it. That's what we're to do. We're to worship the Creator and appreciate the creation. And we can take value from it. We can take things from the creation. We can learn from the creation. God, in all those hundreds of places where he mentions trees and what they're good for and what they can do, or in most cases, or a lot of cases, they use as metaphors. One place he says that the trees clap hands, which we know that a tree can't clap hands, but in a metaphor it can. Psalm again, in Psalm 1, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of waters, that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. If we heed this advice, we can be as fruitful as a tree planted by the water. If it just quietly stands there and provides us with all kinds of benefits and all kinds of good things, doesn't tout itself, doesn't puff itself up and promote itself, it just stands there and does the right thing, does what it's supposed to do. I hope you get the opportunity to go to Traitor's Hollow sometime. It's worth going. If you haven't gone and you have the opportunity sometime, make sure to take advantage of it. But there are many places around that are like Traitor's Hollow that are very beautiful, very inspiring, and creation, part of God's creation, that will help us to understand God better. But if you don't, the next time you see an impressive tree, a big tree, stop and think about it. And think about Psalm 1 and how you and I could be like that tree that's planted by the rivers, by the waters, the rivers of water, that can be productive just by standing there and doing what it's supposed to do.